I remember Ronald Reagan. I remember him in the 1970s when he was a washed-up former governor of California and former B-film actor who nobody gave a chance when he ran for president in 1976. Then I remember him coming back in 1980 and this time taking the prize to be reelected in 1984 and to leave a legacy that, well, it still divides us today. It's easy to see why some people love him. He's got to be one of the most likable characters on the public stage in all of American history. And as the stories go, that's the way he really was in real life. He loved his story. He loved to slap his knee. He was just an all-around grandfatherly good guy. A lot of other people hate him, and it doesn't have to do with his geniality, but really more of his policies. The debate continues today. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the Gipper.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, produced in cooperation with James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches at the Appalachian School of Law.
As you know, this show is underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier, and specifically the Center for the Constitution. And I love the folks out at Montpelier. I try to get out there as frequently as I can, and I do lots of things with them. And one of the things I do every year is I judge the We the People constitutional competition, both the regionals and the state level, and lately I've been doing the national judging as well. It's great fun, and one of the best parts of it is that I get to meet all kinds of interesting people, both from all over the country and from right here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, or I should say right there in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where my law school is. And recently, I met a fellow by the name of Justin Garrison. He's an assistant professor at Roanoke College, which is in Roanoke, Virginia. And Justin and I really hit it off. We had a very pleasant time, a very pleasant conversation. And in subsequent exchange of emails, we agreed that he needed to come on the show and talk about some of his research. And it turns out that his dissertation and now a subsequent book that was published based on that dissertation are all about a fellow you've heard of. And his name is Ronald Reagan. I thought that was sort of curious because Justin's a young fellow, and I, as you'll see in just a moment, one of the first questions I ask him during the interview is whether he even remembers Ronald Reagan. But I certainly remember Ronald Reagan. And I must say, as someone who sort of grew up with Ronald Reagan and was around in the 1980s, who saw the controversies of the era and saw both the positives and the negative, I've been a little bit, I won't say taken aback, I've simply been impressed by the controversy that still surrounds the fellow and how some people on the right seem to deify him and some people on the left just as equally vilify him. He's a very divisive figure for being such a genial kind of guy. And so that's what Justin and I are going to talk about today. His book is called The Chimeric Imagination of Ronald Reagan. There's a fancy word for you, chimeric. I guess that means illusory or fictional, or you look it up yourself. That's how I always read it. And what an interesting title, what an interesting book. And here's Justin Garrison, what an interesting fellow.
Well, who are you and what do you do?
It's a good question, and it's one that I think I can answer.
I'm so pleased.
So, yeah, I'm on a roll. My name is Justin Garrison. I'm a professor of political science at Roanoke College in Salem, Virginia. My wife and I just moved into the New River Valley area about 10 months ago.
Where is Salem, Virginia?
Salem, Virginia is a fiefdom within Roanoke County. So there's the city of Roanoke in which I live, then the broader county, and Salem is its own thing within that. But I think it's assistant professors and higher that have enough money to live in Salem, so it's an aspiration.
I see what you're saying, and I must say that it's only when I have professors of political science in here that I hear the word fiefdom used. And I'm very pleased.
Yes, I'm really into medieval philosophy.
Glad to hear that. So you're at Roanoke College. You're an assistant professor. You're a young whippersnapper, at least compared to all the other old people in the studio now. Where'd you come from?
Well, I originally grew up in Sacramento, California, and lived there until I went to college. And then I took an interesting flyer about a history program that had a concentration in intelligence analysis. And so I ended up going Mercyhurst College in Erie, PA, which is not very close to California.
Uh-huh. You studied intelligence stuff?
Yes. Yeah. I was a real devotee of the X-Files, as many teenagers were. And I decided that the coolest thing in life would be Fox Mulder. And I found out that intelligence isn't quite like that. So I did a few internships with Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati working in competitive intelligence, and I found it wasn't
competitive. It's like when you spy on other companies.
Yes, yes. So instead
cool
of stealing
idea.
Secrets, you're trying to figure out how to make soap and detergent more effectively than Unilever or something like this.
That's really cool, you know, because Procter & Gamble, I've heard, is itself just a vast satanic conspiracy.
Yes,
and
yeah.
So you were part of all that, were you?
You know, there's a lot of information about how that's not true. So you wonder if they protest too much. But yeah, there's the little half moon thing with the stars and all of that. Yeah,
we shouldn't propagate that. It's just a rumor, folks.
Yes,
it's
I love Tide and wash all of my clothes with it. It's wonderful.
Tremendous. Glad to hear that. And but eventually you got a PhD somewhere.
Yeah, you know, I didn't find that intelligence was all for me. So I'm not knocking the field, but I just didn't find that I enjoyed it all that much. And as a requirement for my degree, I had to take a course in political theory. Mm-hmm. And after 10 and a half weeks in that class, that's what I decided to devote my life to.
Tremendous.
And so I asked that professor, where did you go to school? And he went to Catholic University and studied with a man named Klaus Rinn. Dr. Rinn is still there. And so
in
that's
D.C.?
Who I, so that's who I did my dissertation with.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Is this your first academic post then?
It is outside of the university. I earned my PhD in 2010 and taught at Catholic as a lecturer for a couple of years. But this is my first, you know, kind of outside the home.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That the academic job market is very tough, especially in the humanities, so you must be something special. That must have been quite a dissertation.
It was certainly controversial.
What was it on?
It was on Ronald Reagan.
I see.
Yeah,
and
so
this is the germ of this book.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
Absolutely. You know, writing about the tertiary literature on John Locke is something that won't offend anyone, but writing about Ronald Reagan in any capacity is bound to make someone upset. So I've experienced that, and it's been interesting.
You sound like my kind of academic. We don't want any more articles on John Locke. We want articles that are going to make people get them all riled up.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's
no.
apparently what you've done.
Yeah, it's been kind of uncomfortable because, as you mentioned, I'm slightly younger than a lot of people who really remember Reagan or may have worked with him. And so I do feel kind of embarrassed at times bringing this kind of news to people. It's like telling them that Santa Claus isn't real.
Well, I've mentioned your age, and you've confirmed that you are a young whippersnapper. Do you even remember Ronald Reagan? I mean, you were around when he was president, right?
Yeah, I was born, 7 or 8 months before he was elected.
Uh-huh. So you are a Reagan baby.
Yes, yes, that's right. My first memory of him was the Challenger disaster.
Ouch.
We didn't have the any sort of feed at the school. But I remember when I went home from school that day, 86, I must have been kindergarten, first grade or something like this, that this was the only time I had seen a small television on our dinner table. It was this black and white, and we had tuna casserole, and it was a very kind of odd experience. And, you know, my parents had to explain this is what happened and why it's significant. And so that's really my first kind of contact with a conscious memory of when Reagan was president.
Not a very good memory at all. In fact, I realize this isn't directly relevant to what we're going to talk about today, but I remember that day too. In fact, in many respects, that was just as disturbing and moving as 9/11 was for people of our generation, of my generation. It was just very, very sad. You know, the teacher in space was up there, and then it was just horrible. That realization that the spacecraft had exploded, and watching the faces of the people in the crowd, especially Krista McAuliffe's parents. I remember that. That was a devastating day. But now you're depressing me, Justin. So that will
give me a happier memory.
Happier memory of Ronald Reagan, or at least continue the story.
Well, you know, with Reagan, one of the things that he's often, you know, celebrated for on the right and the left is optimism. And I think that as tragic as the Challenger explosion was, you know, that's really one of the defining moments of his presidency. He could have botched that speech. Any president could have botched that speech. But that speech that he gave really, I think, brought as much comfort as you can under those circumstances to an entire nation of people. And so I think that, you know, in those types of moments during his presidency, the vision that he expressed to the American people is pretty profound.
He did have, as I think George H.W. Bush would later say, the vision thing. He was very, very good at that sort of reassurance. In fact, I recall a slightly earlier memory. I was in law school in 1984, and that, of course, was when he was running for reelection. And he did a 30-minute infomercial. I think it was called Sunrise, or what was it, Morning in America. Mm. That's what he called it. And my roommate and I sat and watched the whole thing. Now, that's not something I typically do. But I mean, we finished it and we looked at each other and we started laughing and we said, he is going to get so reelected. Because it was so optimistic, it was so reassuring, it just made you feel good about yourself and good about America. And my gosh, you know, who was that, his opponent? I mean, that fellow Mondale, you know, who would ever vote for him? I mean, Ronald Reagan is our guy. And the funny thing was, is that my roommate was, especially of the two of us, it turns out to be this huge Democrat and very, very liberal. And I don't think he ultimately did vote for Reagan. But at that moment, if the election had been held that moment, he would have.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got the Olympics in Los Angeles, which is a great patriotic moment. You have the debate with Mondale, where Reagan didn't do all that well in the first debate. And then he tells that joke about, in the second one, about, I won't let my opponent's youth and inexperience, you know, be something to criticize. I can't remember the words. That's why I'm not a president.
I won't make an issue out of my opponent's youth and inexperience. Man, it just cracked
people
up.
Well, I mean, even Mondale laughed at that. How can you lose an election after that kind of moment? His sense of humor is really quite striking.
Yeah, it really was. Well, okay, now we've reminded ourselves of the Reagan magic. And so you experienced the Reagan magic as a young person, but at a certain point, I suspect you became somewhat disillusioned with it.
Well, you know, the more I got into the American tradition, learning about the Constitution, reading the Federalist Papers, reading things written by Washington and Jefferson and Adams and Hamilton and so forth, I really began to notice, and this was, you know, more in my graduate studies than anything else, a discrepancy between what Reagan claimed to represent from that era and what people actually thought, and not just in terms of practical policies, which vary with different presidents and different times, but at the level of ideas and imagination, his vision of the world, his vision of America's place in the world was really not as representative as I thought it was. And so this was curious. And I did more research on it as a graduate student and ended up becoming my dissertation and then this book.
So is it fair to say then that as a young person that you had a fairly positive attitude toward Reagan that carried over into your young adulthood that disappeared only with your graduate studies, or were you becoming disillusioned even before then?
Well, I mean, I certainly, you know, the older I got, the more I learned about things, I certainly began to notice a much broader disconnect. This isn't just something associated with Reagan, but a broader disconnect between the kind of early Republican and founding era, its principles, its ideas, its intuitive sense of the world, and how things have gone really over the 20th century.
Okay, and, so not just Reagan. He was part of a bigger phenomenon.
Yeah. And I think that it makes sense, doesn't it, that if Reagan had somehow sprung some sort of completely new vision on the American people, something they never experienced, something they had never heard of, I don't think it would have worked. I think it's precisely because he was able to channel things that people may have vaguely understood or accepted and to present it to them in such powerful imagery that they say, oh my gosh, I've always thought that, but I never put it that way. You know, I mean, I was talking to my father-in-law because, as you know, being an academic, everyone shouldn't ask you, what's your research? What are you working on? Because then you just talk.
Exactly.
And you ask all sorts of people. And I remember my father-in-law
saying, I'm going to give you some marital advice.
Just
stop talking about your research to your wife altogether.
You saw my apology, I think, in this book. If my wife isn't a saint, I don't know what is.
She's not listening today.
No, she has better things to do, like work and subsidize my kind of, you know, academic
Understood.
Lifestyle.
But yes. You're right. People will, you become obsessed with something and then they'll get tired of you. But anyway, you were talking to your father-in-law.
Well, yeah, I was talking to him and he more or less, you know, this is obviously just anecdotal, but he more or less said this thing that, you know, Reagan came to speak in 1980 in Erie, Pennsylvania. And when Reagan gave his stump speech, my father-in-law said, you know, this just seemed like a normal guy, like some person that I would have known saying the things that I believed. I didn't feel like I was being talked at by some, you know, elitist politician, but this was someone that I, you know, could have grown up with or something like this.
Sounds Jacksonian.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there really is kind of a Norman Rockwell dimension to Reagan's public persona, that he's the, you know, kind of lovable grandfather that we all have or remember, and he's just kind of telling you a story, telling you how things are. He's not trying to mislead you or point you in a direction that's manipulative. He's just there to tell you the truth.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Justin Garrison of Roanoke College in Virginia, who's written a really good book about Ronald Reagan. It's a surprisingly controversial book, as we are discovering. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and talk some more with Justin, so stick around.
I'm so excited because it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, the constitutional quiz. And here with me to inflict it upon, to share it with you, is the quiz guy, Doug Smith. Welcome, Doug.
Hey, thanks so much, Stuart. I'm here to inflict.
And you, as indeed you are. Everyone says that. Don't inflict Doug on me today. You got a hard one today?
I don't think it's that hard.
You don't think it's that hard? Well, then we don't have to get a particularly smart contestant, do we?
No, any of your normal contestants will do.
Okay, well, do we have a normal contestant on the line?
Yes, sir, we do.
Perfectly normal. What's your name, sir?
My name is Chris Eads, and I'm calling from Bristol, Tennessee.
Bristol, Tennessee, Rhythm and Roots.
And the world's fastest half mile.
And the world's fastest half mile at Bristol. I just went to the Bristol Motor Speedway for the very first Winston Cup race I've ever been to, and that was a hoot. It was a blast.
I'm sure it was.
Yep, and Bristol is also the site of, it's often called the birthplace of country music, and they have a wonderful festival. I think it's each spring or is it each fall, the Rhythm and Roots Festival?
It is in the spring.
So it's coming up here, I guess.
Yeah.
Tremendous. You going to go?
No, I think I'll probably be swamped with some tests coming up here.
Then let's get past that then and get to it. Doug, what do you got?
Well, I'm a little concerned, Stuart.
Mm-hmm.
Your contestant is already kind of lying. He said he was from Bristol, Tennessee.
Right.
Doesn't he mean Bristol, Virginia?
I don't know. Is it from Tennessee or from Virginia?
It was 100% Tennessee.
And he says that with great strength and vigor because, you know, right running down, the main street of Bristol is called State Street. And literally on one side you're in Virginia and on the other side you're in Tennessee.
Well, I'm glad he could volunteer that information.
Oh, man, you're getting terrible. All righty, go on. What do you got?
All right, here's the question. Are you ready, Chris?
Yes, sir.
What are powers reserved solely for the states called?
Powers reserved? He's cheating. I hear him whispering. Are you bringing in ringers?
No, sir. I am just trying to make sure I have the question down.
Okay. Well, you people from Tennessee, I don't know. I always have to check you on this.
I think it was just he was whispering over the state line into Virginia.
I see. That's what it is.
What are the powers reserved solely to the states called? Are they A, enumerated powers, B, delegated powers, C, reserved or residual powers, or D, bureaucratic powers?
Okay.
What are the powers reserved solely for the states called?
Chris?
Yes, sir. It's definitely not D.
Which is what? That's bureaucratic powers, okay.
Yeah. I'm going to have to rule out C as well.
Okay. Reserve powers? Why are you ruling that one out?
Well, I just don't know any language in the Constitution or in any of my previous experience with states' powers hearing reserved rights.
Okay. What are the other ones?
Delegated with A sounds pretty good.
Well, what's a delegated power in the Constitution?
A right reserved to the state.
You think so?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I guess that's delegated by the federal government to the states.
Oh, I see. Okay, that would be the theory. Okay, yeah. What about A?
Well, isn't delegated A?
No, yeah. A is enumerated.
Oh. Well, then I have my answers confused. I was enumerated would then be the answer to the question of federal government to the state.
Okay, so you think an enumerated power is one that the Constitution gives to the states?
That's my answer choice.
Okay, so that's the one you want. So if a power that's reserved specifically to the state is called an enumerated power.
Yes, sir.
And not a reserve power and not a delegated power and certainly not a bureaucratic power.
Nope.
Doug, I'm looking at you.
Well, you know, the reserved powers, they're actually called reserved powers.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chris.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Wow.
Yeah, enumerated powers are the ones that are enumerated and specifically given to the national government.
It's about the 10th Amendment.
Yeah, and in the 10th Amendment, they say those powers not delegated to the federal government, I'm paraphrasing here, nor prohibited to it, and those are the reserve powers, are reserved to the states individually. So even though reserve powers is not always used, in fact, people will simply say state powers or powers retained by the states, that is actually a term that's used to describe that concept. You see, the basic structure of the Constitution is you create this new government and you give it only specific enumerated powers, and so implicitly and also explicitly in the 10th Amendment, anything you don't give to the national government is kept by the states.
Yeah, so the federal government, I mean, their powers really are to, say it with me,
right.
declare war, collect taxes, regulate interstate business.
Right.
You know, it's the reserve powers, as you say, that are unspoken. Those always go down to the state, as long as they're legal.
Right, right. Exactly right. Well, I'm sorry, Chris. I really am.
Well, it's all right. I guess I'll just have to brush up on my knowledge a little bit and maybe come back next time.
Well, that's okay. You can always come back some other time. Just give us an email, ywc@montpelier.org. But in the meantime, you will get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, and you can read that 10th Amendment a few times.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to now, because I definitely didn't have that down before.
Okay, well, now you do.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having an absolutely marvelous discussion with my buddy Justin Garrison of Roanoke College, who's written a new book all about an old guy, Ronald Reagan.
Yep, he was so likable and such a regular guy. I recall that there was a spoof poster that was done. It was very common when I was in college in the early 1980s, and it was a play on the old Ronald Reagan movie, Bedtime for Bonzo. Well, he was ridiculed for that because his co-star was a chimpanzee, I think.
Yes.
But the poster wasn't Bedtime for Bonzo. It said Bedtime for Brezhnev. And Brezhnev, of course, being the head of the Soviet Union at that time. And then it was this whole, the poster was, it was like it was an old Western movie. And there was Reagan in a white hat, and there were all of his minions in their white hats, and all the Russians in their black hats, and all the rest. And it was a very funny poster. But I remember, even as I kind of snickered at the poster and thought it was very clever, you still saw Reagan in the white hat, and you thought, isn't he a great guy? He's taking care of us. And in fact, I remember the tagline in the poster was, from out of the West, they dusted off their guns to protect the world they knew and the women they loved. And even as you're laughing at this, you're thinking to yourself, yeah, and he's such a cool guy. He's a cowboy. He's going to protect us all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, he clearly has that mystique and that persona about him. You know, one of his jokes about not having met a Soviet leader before Gorbachev was, they kept dying on me, because it was Brezhnev and Andropov and Chernenko.
Right.
You know, so he had that way of deflecting things. It didn't always work. You probably remember the accidental on-air joke about how bombing Russia begins in 5 minutes. So, yes. You know. But we've all, I think, told jokes that didn't go over very well.
Yeah, that's a bad thing. In fact, being in a radio studio now, let's remind people of that. He was in a radio studio. Mm. They were doing a sound check, and he said, as he was just being asked to count to 10, he said, I've decided to outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Right.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And of course, somebody was recording it, and of course it got played back. So he had his share of gaffes as well.
Yeah.
But people were willing to forgive them.
Well, and he would be the first person to poke fun at himself. And if someone has that kind of self-deprecating humor, I mean, what can you really do to them?
Yeah, he did. Okay, well, we've talked a lot about the mystique. See, it's hard to get away from it even now.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the shadow of Reagan looms large over America. I'm sure you've seen these debates. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was in 2012, one of the primary debates in the Republican Party. The question was prefaced, besides Ronald Reagan, like, who do you look up to? Because it's a foregone conclusion,
right?
I mean, what we need, I guess, is, you know, genetic cloning so we can actually get Reagans out there and doing all sorts of things. Because that's the shadow that looms over American politics, particularly on the Republican side, but
right. And it's
on the
often,
left, too.
And it's really remarkable to me because the last couple of years of Reagan's second term were really overshadowed by Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
And by the, you know, like most second terms, there was some difficult sledding, and he seemed to be having a particularly bad time of it. And, you know, some of his people were being prosecuted mm-hmm. all over North, the rest of it. So when he left office, I don't know that it was necessarily on a high note, but his reputation just seems to have rebounded and grown since that time.
Yeah, I think we all look better in hindsight. The further you get away from the events, some of the more contentious aspects of a presidency begin to dissipate. People begin to look more favorably upon the accomplishments. I think we've seen this in a different capacity with a rehabilitation of Harry Truman. You know, Truman left office very unpopular.
Oh, yes.
Now he's, you know, kind of heralded as one of the great presidents of the 20th century by, you know, a number of people, not all, but his reputation has certainly improved. And Reagan has also experienced that. I think one of the major factors of that would be, of course, that the Cold War ended not only successfully from the American perspective, but peacefully. There was no World War III. There was no nuclear conflagration. Who knows what's going on between the United States and Russia these days. But someone who in 1982 goes to the British Parliament and starts talking about, you know, leaving Marxism, Leninism on the ash heap of history, I was two. I didn't obviously watch the speech. I think I had more important things
to
do, like napping.
Well, yeah.
From what I've gathered in my research, these were not uncontroversial statements to be making at the time. And yet, through his efforts, you know, I think it's too far to say he, quote unquote, won the Cold War. But he clearly contributes in a positive way to not only a resolution of that, but a peaceful resolution.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating era. Okay. I keep trying to get us away from the Reagan myth and
Reagan memories
and back to your book.
Yeah.
Because now that we've set that out, you have some criticisms of this. What are the points that you make in your book?
Well, in a nutshell...
By the way, it's called An Empire of Ideals.
Yes.
Okay, there we
are. Yes, thank you. It's An Empire of Ideals, which is a quote that I took from a speech that he gave to the Republican National Convention in 1992, and he said something to the effect of, it used to be the case that empires were defined by land masses and subjugated peoples, but America is unique because we are an empire of ideals. And so there's this ideational and intuitive imperialism, for lack of a better way to put it, in his vision that American values are human values, that the United States has a special mission. A mission appointed by divine power, by providence, to be defenders of liberty, democracy, free markets, and so forth. So that's the title of the book. The subtitle tells you to some extent what I think about this, which is that it's the chimeric imagination of Reagan. And when I use the word chimeric, I mean it in the sense that it's very clear in his speeches that he's a very optimistic person, that he inspires hope in people. But in the predominant strain of his vision, there's a high degree of unreality. And so there may be short-term benefits to be derived from pulling the United States and its people out of the funk of the 1970s. We have high unemployment and a variety of other economic and social problems, but that the long-term kind of consequences of viewing the world the way he does may be rather problematic.
Chimeric, interesting word. Don't see it that frequently. Sort of self-delusional then, because he does seem to have actually believed these things.
I think that's an important point. Because as I've presented this research, I've heard any number of things, which is Reagan was an amiable dunce. Reagan didn't know what was going on. And people just said, say these pretty words. And he said, okay, because I'm still an actor or something like this. That's largely been discredited. But there's another side of thinking through his rhetoric, particularly amongst his admirers. People would say something like, yeah, he would talk about Thomas Paine and beginning the world over again, but it was the Cold War. He needed to rally people. We shouldn't take these things too seriously. Reagan himself may not even have meant them. Maybe this is just kind of rhetorical convention or something like this. I, based on my research, don't find that persuasive. I think Reagan developed this vision that I talk about in the book carefully over decades before becoming president. And he sincerely believed what he said. And I think that's part of the reason it's so darn appealing to people. You can tell when someone isn't telling you the truth.
Often you can. What exactly is this disconnection between the founders and between the Reagan philosophy? Because there are several different aspects of Reagan's imagination and his ideals that you criticize. But I think the first one, the foundational one, is that you simply say that the founders didn't say what Reagan said the founders said.
Yes. Reagan is deeply enamored of Thomas Jefferson, and I live in the state of Virginia, so I'll tread lightly on this.
That's all right.
But, Jefferson's political thought may not be as representative of the broader tradition of political thinking at that time as some would believe. He was also strongly inclined to quote from Paine's Common Sense, this passage that I just mentioned. Paine is even less representative of the founding era than figures like Washington, Adams, Hamilton, even to some extent Madison. So what is it about the founding that Reagan doesn't represent? My understanding of things, at least, when you look at texts like the Federalist Papers, you look at the actual events of the American War for Independence, the Americans, in contrast to the people who initiated the French Revolution, particularly the Jacobins, the Americans had rather modest expectations. They weren't, to borrow from Thomas Paine, trying to start the world over again, so much as they had grown for over a century as colonists. They had grown up in a tradition of the customary rights of Englishmen, which they're arguing for as late as 1774 in the declarations and resolves of the First Continental Congress. They're saying we want the rights of Englishmen and the rights of nature, so they're using both kinds of language. they had grown accustomed to a particular way of life, a way of life that put an emphasis on decentralized political power, an emphasis on responsible liberty, an emphasis relative to its day on equality. And they were, in my view, trying to recapture as much of that as is possible, first through the conventions of the British Empire. And when that became impossible, they fought a war of rebellion to get back to that spirit of self-government. That's very different from the founding that Reagan tells us about when he went to Yorktown in 1981 to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Washington's victory. He talked exclusively in terms that suggested that the American Revolution was all about ideas, about those four or five words in the second paragraph of the Declaration about self-evident truths, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness being our rights as human beings. He reduces or drains the American Revolution of any of its significant historical context and just turns it into kind of a crusade for universal principles. And I think that distorts the American tradition.
So it was really more of a specific rebellion to a specific set of political conditions, certainly with a good dose of idealism mixed in, but not necessarily quite the crusade that Reagan characterized as being. But that's pretty standard American stuff, right? I mean, people, we like to think of our conception as our birth as being something that was greater than just a bunch of guys who didn't like taxes.
Yes. Yes, that's true. And I think that's an important point to raise.
And that goes back to your original point, is that Reagan was telling people what they, in some sense, already believed.
Right. And so when you're looking at the colonial sources, when you're looking at the founding sources, when you're looking at other sources in the early Republican period, after the founding, but before the 20th century gets rolling, you clearly see numerous instances of what is typically referred to as American exceptionalism. The United States is different from everyone else. We're special somehow. The question for me, though, is what is the nature of that uniqueness? And I think what you see in many of the sources from the founding period and the early Republican period is what a scholar like Walter McDougall would call America conceived of as a promised land. It's a special place. It's a place that sets itself up as an example for the world to hopefully emulate, to become freely, choose to be like Americans, respect liberty, respect limited government, and so forth. That's a very different understanding of American exceptionalism than one that would conceptualize the United States as something more of a crusader state or a Christ nation or something like this.
A city on the hill, to borrow a phrase.
Yes, yes. And so that in and of itself is quite interesting. When you look at that language, it's obviously it's all the way back to the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is not talking to Americans. But talking to his disciples.
Wait a minute. I thought Jesus was an American.
He was, but, you know, that's a different translation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It doesn't have any explicit political meaning. John Winthrop, as we know, brings this over with his Model of Christian Charity sermon. And there's a really interesting caveat. We are a city upon a hill, which means that the people then coming to the Massachusetts Bay Colony have been set up either to do something really great, or if they fail, the world will know. And so there's some ambivalence there. They really have a lot of moral responsibility.
Winthrop was really saying more that we're under a microscope.
Yes, absolutely.
Rather than we're necessarily the positive example. No, we're a very prominent example, and it could go either way.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it. He says that about a century later. Jonathan Edwards, Mr. Cheerful himself, says that. And then the language kind of drops out. You know, there's a scholar named Richard Gamble who's written about this symbol, the city on the hill symbol. And you see it come back into vogue in the U.S. with John F. Kennedy. The really interesting thing about that image, though, is that it is, not surprisingly, Reagan who adds the word shining.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. I'm having a perfectly fascinating conversation with my friend Justin Garrison from Roanoke College. And we're talking all about his book on Ronald Reagan. And most recently, we've been discussing the imagery that Reagan evoked in his speeches. He was quite a communicator. Love him or hate him, he knew how to present his side of history. After the break, we will finish our discussion with Justin, and there's lots more interesting stuff to come, so stay with us. And now let's finish our discussion with Justin Garrison of Roanoke College. Before the break, we were talking about that old image that Ronald Reagan evoked of the United States, that shining city on a hill. And apparently he's the one who added the word shining. Or maybe it was Peggy Noonan.
A shining city on a hill. And so whereas we could be under a microscope. Reagan's vision seems to suggest that if we are, the results are in. And guess what? We may not be perfect, but we are better than everyone else.
He makes it sound sort of like Oz, a gleaming, well, it was an emerald city in that case, but it was a shining city and very prominently placed. To summarize that aspect of it then, the founders and many people who preceded the founders saw us as an experiment that could go awry or could succeed, and we had to work really hard to make it succeed. And Reagan was saying the experiment has worked, and look at how great we are.
I don't want to say that's all he said, but yeah, that's really where the emphasis in the vision is. Whereas the founders had a very clear sense of what we could describe as human ethical dualism. We can do well, we can do poorly. We have both impulses to will the good or to will evil. We can use Christian language and talk about original sin. They had a real strong sense that human beings were flawed creatures, and that a realistic vision of politics would be one that doesn't have utopian expectations. If you put the question to Reagan, he would of course say, of course. Of course, politics has to take that into account. But when you look at where he becomes the most vivid, where he becomes the most engaged, and where he tends to lay the most emphasis, it's not on this notion that there's a great deal of striving to be done and we could fail. It's much more, we just need to remember our greatness and it will become manifest. There's really not much of a premium in his vision put on what I would call ethical striving.
Isn't that interesting? Because as you talk about ethical striving, you remind me of Jimmy Carter.
I mean, great.
That was his message that, you know, we have a malaise, that we've got to get out of it. We've got to work harder. We've got to pull together. You know, there was a lot of positive in the things he said, but there was also a lot of negative. And there was, in a sense, it was a much more realistic description of the situation we found ourselves in. That did not sell very well.
No.
He was not nearly considered the great communicator Reagan was. And I don't know if that was necessarily because of the way he looked or the way he spoke as much as that his message was just not nearly as optimistic and positive.
Well, I'm sure you've encountered this in the classroom. When you give students difficult feedback, more often than not, it's not met with, gee, thanks. You've really helped me understand where I'm falling short, and I will strive to do better. I have yet to meet that student. You might meet that student a couple of semesters later. They come into your office and say, hey, you remember a couple of years ago? Well, that really helped. But more often than not, when you tell people things that they may need to hear but aren't necessarily interested in hearing, you're not going to be met with a great deal of praise. And
no, you are not. More often than that, either with anger or tears.
Yes.
I have noticed both. But you're right. Occasionally, years later, you will hear from them. I liken it also to child rearing. I mean, with your own children, every parent knows. That you cannot simply continually praise them and tell them how great they are because they're not going to be very great. You've got to leaven that with some constructive criticism, and you've got to let them know when they fall short because that's what parents have to do. But that doesn't make you popular in the short run.
Right. Yeah, and so that's I think, the important point is even if one were to think about American politics as being in a rather dangerous situation— it would be irresponsible to just kind of begin your inaugural address with, it's all over, folks. There's nothing we can do. Get the lifeboats out and start, you know, paddling in any direction. Even if you really felt that way, that would be irresponsible. But it doesn't mean that there aren't ways of communicating a sense in which things might not be working very well that would not be so offensive as this kind of extreme example I just gave.
I'm thinking of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There was a guy faced with two enormous crises, first the Depression, then the Second World War. And in both cases, he didn't sugarcoat it. I mean, he let people know just how bad it was, as if they needed reminding in either case. Well, certainly in the case of the Depression, they didn't need anyone to point it out, but he did. He acknowledged how terrible things were, but then he would end on a high note. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and he would go on from that point and be inspirational. In my mind, I think maybe he would be even a better communicator than Reagan. Now, I know that, you know, I'm not trying to take political positions. I'm simply saying he's actually, at least what I've read of his speeches, he's very, very upfront about the negatives, but he tends to end on the positive.
No, and I think that in that respect, he and Reagan are very similar. One of my favorite anecdotes, and no student ever laughs as hard as this as they should, Okay. But Reagan would tell this story about these two brothers, and one of them was a pessimist beyond belief, and the other was an incurable optimist. And the father's very upset because his children don't have balanced visions of the world. So he takes them to a psychologist and says, you know, these are my kids, and this is their problem. What are we going to do? And the psychologist says, okay, we're going to take this kid who's the pessimist, we're going to put him in a room filled with toys. No boy could be upset if he's in a room filled with toys. This will fix him. What about the optimist? What are we going to do with him? Well, let's put him in an unclean horse stall. No one could be happy in a stall filled with muck. And so the dad says, okay, this sounds reasonable. And they put the kids in the positions and they go to check on them and they go to the pessimist first. And he immediately grabs as many toys as he can and says, I knew someone's going to come in here and take these things from me. So the pessimist isn't cured. So they go to the horse stall. And before they get there, they see muck flying all over the place. Gosh, what's wrong? So they go to the stall. And the kid is stripped down to his, you know, shirt. He's taking his shirt off. He's in his pants. And he is covered in muck. And they're like, what are you doing? And the kid says, if there's this much muck, there's got to be a pony in here.
I remember
now,
that story.
Yeah, now and Reagan is the guy who always finds the pony.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which both he and FDR, and if you remember the, you know, from reading the speech he gave on behalf of Goldwater,
mm-hmm.
he steals that line about we have a rendezvous with destiny.
Yes.
You know, he was just 16 years off. It wasn't Goldwater, it was Reagan.
Right.
You know, Reagan thought very highly of FDR. His dad was an FDR Democrat and worked with the WPA.
Reagan started out as a Roosevelt Democrat.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
I think probably because he was attracted to him in
sure.
that regard, as were millions of other Americans.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the other kind of interesting parallels, although Reagan doesn't quite exercise this power to the same degree, is they have very similar conceptions of executive power. Everyone remembers the line, we have nothing to fear but fear itself from the first inaugural, but right at the end, Roosevelt explains that while he hopes Congress will do the right thing and pass the legislation that needs to be passed, he more or less invokes the war powers to say, if Congress doesn't get it done, I'm going to. Now, I know that we're all very comfortable these days with declaring war on abstractions, but declaring war on the Depression, I mean, where do you tilt the lance?
Mm-hmm.
There's something kind of odd about that. Now, Reagan is typically considered to be a conservative. And I talk about this in the book, and it depends on, to some extent, how you define that word. But in a meaningful sense, I think it's a dubious claim. And it's when it comes to something like executive power, where you see a much more kind of Wilsonian conception, a much more Rooseveltian conception of the relationship between the president and the American people, and as a consequence, what the president should be able to do with governmental power.
The president and the Congress. I mean, Reagan and Roosevelt and Wilson were all very strong presidents, and they were willing to take executive power as far as the public would let them take it.
Right.
Occasionally to their great chagrin.
Sure.
But they all were very similar. So, yeah, I mean, maybe the goals they were working toward or their visions of what government should be doing were different, but their willingness to use their own powers to get there were very similar. You're going to say something about the idea of progress and that you criticized Reagan's conception of that concept. What was up with that?
By way of full disclosure, I am a hypocrite on this point. I have an iPhone. I have an Apple computer. I have a picture of Steve Jobs. You know, it's all technology. So I don't want this to sound as if I'm some sort of Luddite. That being said, what is problematic about Reagan's vision is Reagan, as he says on numerous occasions in his presidential speeches, he really wants to get Americans dreaming again. In one speech, he says, let us cultivate the art of seeing things invisible. That, to me, is a very kind of odd statement to make about seeing politics rightly. So what does Reagan mean when he uses the word progress? It's primarily technological progress, and it's quantifiable things. And you know, to some extent, of course, you can see this in his own life. And he exaggerates this slightly. He was not in a horse and buggy era. But, you know, he talks about this more or less saying we've gone from the horse and buggy to people on the moon in less than a century. And clearly this must mean great things are upon the horizon. And when you, I think, confuse technological or material progress with ethical progress, that's problematic for politics. And so he'd have these instances on rare occasions where he might intuit that. And so he talks about things like nuclear weapons. You know, Reagan is very much opposed to nuclear weapons in the sense that he doesn't think of them as just some sort of unmitigated good. He's against the nuclear freeze movement for various reasons, but he's not comfortable with them because obviously I think if you have this ridiculously named nuclear football, you know that there are serious consequences for pushing those buttons, so to speak.
The nuclear football is the briefcase that contains all of the codes
right.
that the president, only the president can give. And there's a fellow who literally follows him
yeah.
around night and day with this thing.
Yeah, because when the fate of the world is at hand, call it a football. It's very, very serious. So he gives this speech and he's talking about these kinds of dangers and the possibilities of total nuclear annihilation. And he talks about, you know, how when he was in college, they would have discussions about things like, can you, you know, do mass bombing campaigns in cities when you know you're going to inevitably kill civilians? And when he was in college, the answer was, oh, no, that's terrible. That's not civilized. And that, you know, a couple of decades later, well, yeah, maybe that's necessary. And so he has this intuition, but then he immediately transitions into what? The Strategic Defense Initiative. Technology, which has put us under threat of literal annihilation, is also going to be the thing that will save us from annihilation. So what will SDI do? Allow us to ignore the human problem. You don't need to be an ethically mature individual to develop missiles that can shoot down other missiles before those missiles explode. And so he ignores the kind of ethical dimension of progress and focuses almost exclusively on the material stuff. And, you know, what that might mean is that while we have become more efficient, without the type of inner restraint that we need as human beings, we may only become efficient megalomaniacs. That's a problem.
This is Stuart Harris. I'm speaking with Justin Garrison about Ronald Reagan. And I just had to cut out a whole bunch of our interview. We just kept talking for a long time because he's such a fascinating fellow. Both Reagan and Justin, both fascinating fellows. But I did, before we close, I did want to ask Justin about Reagan's legacy. And so let's finish with that.
I think that his vision, of course, is still with us. When Bush 43 was elected, it was, here is the second coming of Ronald Reagan. And when things began to go badly for him in his second term in particular, it was, well, it's because he's not Reagan. You know, he somehow lost the mantle or he hasn't measured up. Whether it was because of just kind of rhetorical, conventional pressure or what, who's to say? But even in his first presidential debate, you know, Barack Obama would be talking about a shining beacon on a hill and kind of appropriating this language. And you may remember that when he was in the primary stage with Clinton, you know, he made this pointed reference of saying, people like Ronald Reagan changed the trajectory of the United States. I don't think Nixon or Clinton did. And I mean, the implications of the Clinton mention at the time, I think, were fairly obvious. Mm-hmm. As things started to go a little bit difficult for President Obama in 2010, 2011, there were op-eds and other things written about, you know, he's trying to figure out how Reagan dealt with similar difficult economic times when in 81 and 82, it was not at all clear that he was going to be reelected winning 49 of 50 states. I mean, those are really serious, challenging times for people in terms of finding jobs, having enough income to provide for themselves. So that language, that vision is still with us. Yeah. And so it's very difficult. I mean, Tennessee Williams was really onto something. If the illusion is shattered, what are you left with?
The Iceman cometh. Oh, no, that was Eugene O'Neill.
Right.
Same thing. Yeah. Well. So you managed to offend your peers. You managed to offend other people at conferences. I imagine some people besides your mom liked your book.
Yeah, my wife likes it. my dissertation advisor liked it. There have been people that have also said, this is refreshing. Mm-hmm. It's nice to see someone who clearly doesn't have an agenda. You know, I mean, so many of the books written about Reagan are written, Reagan is either the second most important person in human history after Jesus, or he's Mephistopheles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way of breaking out of that. And those types of books are still being written to this day. And I don't have a stake in it in that way. As I, you know, mentioned earlier, I was born right before he was elected president. And so I just tried to provide a dispassionate assessment using the tools of political theory to analyze, okay, this is what he said, so what's really here? Because Reagan obviously isn't a philosopher, and he doesn't need to be. I'm not trying to criticize him. He tells stories. He's giving you pictures, images to hold in your mind. Liberty is like this. Freedom is like that. Okay, so let's put it together systematically and see ultimately what kind of vision of politics we're going to get. Now, I would just want to be clear that while the book focuses on what I think is the predominant strain of his way of seeing the world and America's place in it, this isn't the only thing that's on his mind. He does have these moments where a more kind of practical side comes to light. You know, for all of the bellicose things he says in the early 80s relating to the Soviet Union, when he finally gets to meet Gorbachev, it's a different story. And I mean, the story to some extent fits with this imagination. Well, Gorbachev isn't so bad because he's really not like one of them. He's like one of us who just has some kind of crummy ideas that we need to straighten out or something like this.
Just happens to speak Russian.
Yeah, you know, but yeah. That's, yeah, they got translators for that.
He's a regular guy.
It's good to be the president.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so there is that sense in which there were a number of people to his right during the second his second administration that didn't want him to meet with Gorbachev, that didn't want him to kind of extend that olive branch to the Soviet Union, because we know who they are. We know what they're like. They're always the same way. And I think Reagan, much to his credit, took that chance and really was able to kind of foster a better international relationship with the Soviet Union and a better relationship between himself and a leader of that now defunct, perhaps resurgent, nation. We don't know what Putin's going to do.
Well, Justin Garrison, this has been a fascinating discussion, and it's been fascinating also to hear about how much outrage and controversy your book has inspired. And I have only one comment to make about that. You may have compared Reagan with Karl Marx, but at least you didn't compare him with Hitler.
Right. Yeah. I guess, you know, I should have brought in a picture or something, because we all know that's the height of political discourse in this country. You just get anyone's picture and you draw the mustache on them and case closed.
Case closed.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be for the sequel.
All righty. Well, once again, it's called An Empire of Ideals. It was published by who? By the Routledge Company.
Yes.
Okay. And it's available on
Through Amazon, through the Routledge website.
And that's spelled Routledge.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. Okay. It was published in February of 2013.
Tremendous. And so people can get this. I recommend it. It's highly readable. In fact, I'll give you a compliment. Most academic writing is a little difficult. You have clear prose, and I enjoyed it.
Even the most critical readers of this have complimented me on that.
So at least they liked your letters.
Right. They said, you may be a complete moron, but you write okay. So, you know, if you can win them over at that stage, then you can build on it.
And that's our show. Wasn't that a great interview with Justin Garrison of Roanoke College? Thanks, Justin. Come on back anytime. We'll talk about Reagan or anything else you want to talk about. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part, just as much as Ronald Reagan was. You are a part of the American experiment. Next time on your weekly Constitutional, we speak with Justin Garrison of Roanoke College all about his book on Ronald Reagan. Yep, he wrote one for the Gipper.